So my name is Ratna Prabha, and I'll be talking about Ratnasambhava today. Now, as you've probably gathered, there are two basic ways in Buddhism of making sense of life, or of making sense of how you move towards enlightenment, towards awakening. And one of these is the model of the journey, or the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the three trainings and so on. We need to discover what direction our life is heading in, and what's the next step, and how can we take that step. That's the model of the path. And the other model is the model of the mandala. We need to discover what is central in our life and what we'd really like to be central. We look at everything else and we arrange it round that central focus in a harmonious and well-connected way. So that's the mandala approach. So the Santra is explaining on the first talk how we can use the mandala model to look at what our life is like now, to sort of assess it, to size it up, being very honest about where our energy and time is going. So what is really there at the middle of the mandala? What are our priorities? And those are the things that you put near the centre. And other things are further out, and maybe we can draw lines between the different things to show how they connect together. So this is drawing your own personal mandala. And then we can also draw our ideal mandala, what we'd like our life to be, how we'd like it to be arranged. What is the thing, if we're honest, that really deep down matters most to us? It might be something that for the moment doesn't receive all that much time and energy. So it's not at the middle of our personal mandala, but it's at the middle of our ideal mandala, because that's what we really most deeply care about. And this is not an easy thing to do if you tried it. How do you define what is at the centre of your ideal mandala? And of course it can change, it might shift and evolve or even switch radically. So you don't want to be too specific, too fixed about it. So for example, someone, if you ask them, well, what is really most important in your life? Well, they might say, what's most important in my life is my family. That is what's, you know, that is what I'm arranging my life around. Well, if you asked, what's the reason for that? Why do you care so much about your family? And then they might explain, well, there are values involved with it. There are values of the commitment that I've made. There's the responsibility of the connections, looking after the next generation, the children, and making sure they get a good start in life, expressing love and caring within the family context. So all those values would be tied up with that central point in the mandala of the family. It might be that if you're asked about your ideal mandala, you might be more idealistic about it and say, oh well, I'm a Buddhist. The three jewels are at the centre of my ideal mandala, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But, you know, that's not enough really. You need to pick that out a bit. What does that mean for you personally? How would you express that in your life? It might be, let's say you were a school teacher and a vocational school teacher, not just someone who was doing it because they couldn't get any other job, but you really cared about that. And as you drew your ideal mandala, you might put the value of education in human life at the centre of your mandala. But then you start to ask deeper questions. Why is it that educating people matters so much to me? Maybe it's because I can see that knowledge of the world and knowledge of oneself are essential for a really fulfilled life, and I'd like to help people to arrive at greater knowledge of themselves and of the world. So then I might say, well, it's awareness and understanding that are the real values at the centre, and out of that, my love for education, my job as a school teacher, emerges. That's why I want to facilitate increasing the degree of awareness in others as well as in myself. So you can see how useful this exercise can be, the exercise of the personal mandala. And if you want to, I do suggest, if you haven't already, that you try it. Get a sheet of paper, write down maybe those two mandalas, the personal mandala and the ideal mandala, and just see what they look like. Now, on this retreat, we're looking at the traditional Buddhist mandala of the five Buddhas, the five jinnas or conquerors. Now, this mandala is not words. It's pictures, it's images. And it contains mythical living beings. So it's rather different from the mandala where you put love or awareness or education at the centre. Because at the centre, there is a Buddha. Now, why is this? Why have we got a mandala of images instead of words? And why is there a Buddha at the centre of that mandala? Well, it arises, historically speaking, from the enormous significance that Buddhists have always given to the Buddha. And this is partly because, in a way, obviously, the Buddha was the man who founded Buddhism. As far as we know, he was the first in our age to gain enlightenment, awakening, and also to show others how to do it. But that's not the only reason. It's also because the Buddha is not just the historical founder of Buddhism, but he's also a symbol. He's a symbol for the awakening, the enlightenment, which is potential in everybody, in every human being, in each one of us. So if you did have a word at the centre of the Buddhist mandala, that word would be awakening or enlightenment. But can you see how much more sort of vivid, more fascinating, how much easier it is to connect with it if there's not a word at the centre, not a concept, but a human face, a human body, a human form, the body of an enlightened human being, perhaps the body, the form of you, as you would be if you were fully awake. So, that has been an image that's always been in the minds of Buddhists down the ages, the image of the Buddha. The image, they love to think of the Buddha as he sat there in deep meditation at the foot of the Bodhi tree at the time of enlightenment. And around the Buddha, they arranged everything else in Buddhism. They saw him walking out from that central point as he decided to rise from the Vajrasana, the enlightenment seat, and go and create a movement, create Buddhism. Teach out of compassion. And they saw him walking out from that central point and trekking around northeastern India, ordaining people into his new Sangha, working out what the Dharma, what the teachings, what the practices were going to be. So the Bodhi tree, with the enlightened Buddha, in a way always seen sitting under it, was at the centre of Buddhism. And the whole of the rest of Buddhism became an area arranged around that. Buddhism is a mandala. This is the origin of the mandala. So if you actually think yourself back into 5th century BC India and that beautiful little grove of trees at Bodh Gaya near a river in the heat of summer, somebody sitting there under one of those trees in the shade, meditating, that area immediately around the tree was given a name. And the name for that area was the Bodhi Munda, the circle of awakening. So we can see already in very early Buddhism, the mandala is beginning to appear with the historical Buddha sitting there at the centre. But gradually, in the depths of their meditations, the great teachers of Buddhism held in their awareness that image of the Bodhimanda, the circle of awakening, and it became brighter, it became more vivid, it became less just a memory of a place they'd visited on pilgrimage, but it became something that was present in the depths of their mind, in their imagination. It became more archetypal, more like something from a lucid dream. They became enriched by people's imaginations. And as they envisaged it, they saw it as a ground not made of earth, but made of millions of tiny diamonds. This jewel ground around the Bodhi tree. And I'll say more about that later in the talk. But they also saw the tree itself hung with banners, flags, and gemstones. And they saw animals and spirits gathering around to gaze in awe at the Buddha as he sat in enlightenment. So you can imagine all this happening as you're in deep meditation, just contemplating the form of the Buddha at the time of his enlightenment. And as time went on, that simple figure of a solitary man in meditation became much more. It became a symmetrical diagram of a palace with the enlightened one at the centre, and figures representing aspects of enlightenment in the four quarters, as Vasantra described. And the central Buddha became a mythic, an archetypal Buddha, Virochana, the illuminator. Below him, so in the centre there, and below him in the eastern quarter, was Akshobhya, the blue Buddha of the east, who we met yesterday. And today we're going to have a look at the southern quarter, Ratnasambhava, to the left. And tomorrow it'll be Amitabha, the red Buddha of the west. And finally, because we're going to go to the centre finally, but the day after tomorrow it'll be the green Buddha of the north. Okay, so I've said that Buddhism has got two ways of making sense of the Buddhist life. One is the mandala, the other is the path, the journey, step-by-step progress towards enlightenment. But they're not exclusive alternatives. The two can actually be combined. And that's what we're trying to do in this retreat. You can imagine them, you can combine them by imagining entering the mandala through the eastern gate. So you come in this way, and then inside the mandala you move clockwise around it, visiting the realm of each of the Buddhas in turn, and then moving towards the centre, the complete fulfilment of the centre. And this represents a path, and I should say this is a completely traditional way of using the mandala. So, if you do that, does it make sense to you to start with the blue Buddha in the east? What does Akshobhya represent? Akshobhya represents awareness and integration. And can you see how vital it is that that needs to be there right from the very beginning? You may not perfect it at the beginning, but you have to start off with some awareness, with some wholeness, with some integration. You must actually be present. You can't start anything, according to Buddhism, without awareness. You could almost say that awareness at different levels is the highest value in Buddhism. You must be present. You must learn to be fully embodied. You must learn to be grounded, touching the earth. You mustn't be just off in fantasies and plans and worries, but be actually here. And then the other wonderful qualities that are developed in Buddhism can start to come into being. They're impossible without at least some awareness. So that's why we start with Akshobhya, and that's what we saw yesterday. So what comes next? What comes after Akshobhya? And to try and get a sense of this, I want you to turn on a little switch. Switch on your imagination and take yourself out into a snowy forest in midwinter. We've got rainy weather at the moment, but if you imagine that sort of a lovely, glittering, frosty weather, but it's not quite so nice. The year is turning, it's the depths of winter. There's just that vague promise of increasing light and spring as we go through the solstice. But what's happened to you in this imaginary journey is that you are lost. It's been a long, dark night in the middle of the winter. You've been wandering in a rather frightening, snow-filled forest, lost, beginning to despair. When will you ever find your way out? Will the night ever finish? And you're trudging through the wet snow. you're chilly, you're miserable. But then very gradually, in the east, the sun begins to rise. And at last you can see where you are. You can behold this beautiful, glittering world around you. You can behold the dark blue sky above you with still some stars shining in it. The Russian poet Pushkin has a phrase, "Frost and sun, a day of wonder. Frost and sun, a day of wonder. Spaciousness." So you can see where you are at last. You can see where you're going. Awareness has dawned. That is the starting point. The light is there. There's enough light for you to see where you're going. You've entered the gate of Akshobhya. And instead of panicking and worrying about being lost and what you might meet and what might happen to you, you can now climb up a little hill, have a good look around you, find out where you are, and you can sit down and just relax in mindfulness. Integration. You can collect yourself. You can collect all your mental and emotional resources together. And there, as you look down from the hill, down in the valley, you can see in the dawn light a little brick house with smoke rising from the chimney and a golden glow coming from the windows. It seems incredibly friendly, little house. And there's even a murmur of voices. So down you go. This is going to be your staging post. This is where you hope to recuperate and get your energies back. So you walk down to the cottage, you knock on the door, and you're welcomed into the warm interior. There are other people there with you. You're given a coffee and a hot steaming bowl of porridge, and you're made to feel like an honoured guest. You can sit there, warm yourself in front of the open fire. This is the realm of Ratnasambhava. This is the realm of positive emotion I want to look at today. So do you get a feel for this this movement from the dawning of the light and finally entering the warmth as you realise, I feel at home. I feel there's something of real value here. Now, as I think of this very miniaturized version of Ratnasambhava's realm, this welcoming cottage, for me, the role of Ratnasambhava is taken by a woman. And she's somebody who was very important in my childhood. This is what I think of, this is what I imagine, the hostess who's giving me the coffee and the porridge and all that kind of thing. I've been thinking about her a lot lately because she died a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I loved her very, very much. She was a very important part of my childhood. My sister and I would often spend time in her rambling old house in a village in Warwickshire, visiting her two sons who were her own age. And outside the house, there were roses, there were beehives. Inside, there was this big open fire, this welcome, pies and sausage rolls and all sorts of things like that. And she was enormously welcoming. She was a very, very generous woman. She was very loving towards her own two boys, but she was also very loving towards my sister and myself. She'd been trained as a children's nurse, which is how we knew them, because my mother was also a children's nurse. But much more than that, she took in foster children. So I do have a memory of at times a long table surrounded by, as I remember it, dozens of children all tucking in to their chips and then their custard. And there seemed to be no limit to her generosity. She just really cared about people, especially children. And her life was dedicated to creating a safe, nourishing, rich world for us all. So she's the presiding figure in that little cottage. She's the representative of Ratnasambhava, and probably we all know somebody a bit like that, in different ways at least. And again, this is the way, I think, to make something like the mandala more vivid. It's an archetypal mythic realm. It's imaginary, in a sense, but it also connects with our experience, and you need to make those connections, I think, somehow. So the place of warmth, gold and firelight, tables covered with delicious food, convivial and friendly company, the realm of Ratnasambhava. And I use the word realm because really this is a miniaturized version. Ratnasambhava presides over a vast, fertile land. He rules over the southern realm. And like all the Jinnas, all the Buddhas, he's a king. He's a regal figure. He's a prince. And his origin is in visions of Sri Lanka, in the place of jewels. Sri Lanka, Serendip was the old name for Sri Lanka. So if you imagine that you were a Buddhist in northern India and you thought of a magical southern realm, you would have heard from the merchant travellers tales of old Serendip, the emerald mines, the great golden statues, the tropical, luscious, fertile tropical land of Serendip. So I think this is Ratnasambhava's realm, is at least a mythic version of Sri Lanka. So the presiding figure, the king of this realm, is not my Auntie Mary, actually. Yeah. It's Ratnasambhava. And Ratnasambhava is yellow in colour. He's normally got rather more clothes and ornaments than Amrita's lovely picture here, but I thought I'd let you have a look at a picture so you can get something vivid in your mind. He's seated in meditation. His left hand is holding, can you guess what that is? A jewel. His left hand is holding a jewel, and his name, Ratnasambhava. Ratna means a jewel. Sambhava means born. And in fact, there are two interpretations of this. It may be that he is born from jewels, but according to Lama Govinda, he says it means that he gives birth to jewels, especially the three jewels of Buddhism. And his right hand, now his right hand is quite similar to the right hand of Akshobhya, but can you detect a difference? The palm is outwards rather than inwards, isn't it? So there's a change that's happened. It's as if Akshobhya has been reaching forward to touch the earth, but now he raises his hand up and turns it outwards. And this is very, very significant. This is really the change, the main change, you could say, from Akshobhya to Ratnasambhava, that gesture, turning the palm outwards. The gesture of generosity, the Varada Mudra, the gesture of giving. And also, not in this picture, but usually, the throne of Ratnasambhava is supported by two animals, and those animals are horses. And you could maybe imagine that Ratnasambhava is riding a huge golden chariot drawn by two wonderful golden horses with long flowing manes, maybe dark chestnut brown manes and golden yellow coats, fiery, their nostrils sort of flaring and sort of steam coming out of them, stamping, jingling of the bridles and so on. So what's he associated with, Ratnasambhava? I mean, do have a look in Vasantra's book. It's got a lot of wealth of detail about the Jinnas, and there's a wonderful chapter on Ratnasambhava, and I'm not going to... I was thinking, oh yes, you know, Vasantra's chapter, I should be able to summarise that quite easily in a talk of three quarters of an hour, but actually I'm not going to, there's far more in there. But a few of the associations, ripening grain... Does that make sense? The midday sun, the summer, the glorious summer, riches and abundance, generosity, but not just generosity, but all the positive emotions, beauty and attractiveness, the attraction of the sparkling jewels. He's associated with the earth element. The yellow clay of the earth, the fertile earth out of which the grain grows. He's associated with the skanda of feeling, the emotional response, the response whereby we welcome or sometimes reject our experience. On the wheel of life, the Tibetan wheel of life, his realm is the realm of the human beings. So he's the Buddha that presides over our realm, the human realm. And he transforms the weakness that human beings have. And that weakness, according to the Tibetan Wheel of Life, is pride. The particular weakness that we specialize in is pride. If you're one of the hungry ghosts, you specialize in craving. If you're one of the tormented spirits, you specialize in hatred. If you're an Asya, one of the titans, you specialize in envy and jealousy. If you're an animal, you specialize in ignorance. If you're a human being, you specialize in pride. And this is quite interesting, pride. Pride is comparing yourself to others. Pride is self-obsession. Pride is thinking you're no good, as well as thinking you're wonderful. So that kind of thing is the human speciality. We specialize in this because we're social, because we're engaging, interacting with others. And Ratnasambhava transforms that poison, that klesha of pride. Now, what does he transform it into? He transforms it into one of the five wisdoms. Each of the jhanas has a wisdom associated with them. You remember the mirror-like wisdom for Akshobhya. In the case of Ratnasambhava, he transforms pride into the wisdom of equality, the wisdom that recognizes the underlying affinity between all living beings, between all human beings. It undermines that sense of I am special, I am me, I am at the center of everything. The equality says everybody matters, everybody is special, everybody has the potential for enlightenment. And I'm going to talk more about that in the talk next week, if you're staying on for that. His hand is turning out, and I want to say a bit more about that now. His hand is turning out in a sort of a meeting. From that inward awareness, that awareness out of which the beginnings of wisdom appear, he is now opening up. He's looking around him. He's aware of himself. He's got that mirror of Akshobhya, but he's now turning his hand outwards. And he's meeting, and he's greeting, and he's giving to everybody. That's what this gesture means. So, the stage of the path, you've entered the mandala through the angle of awareness. The stage of the path you meet as you come round from the east into the south is positive emotion. You've moved from the awareness, the beginnings of awareness, the opening of awareness, to an awareness that embraces everybody. Positive emotion is a form of awareness, but it's awareness that is open to the fullness of yourself and everybody else. And I think you could say, again, at least from a traditional Buddhist point of view, that positive emotion starts with a particular response known as Shraddha. And Shraddha means confidence, heartfelt confidence. This is what happens next with awareness. It's the point of opening up to something bigger. What you realize, maybe when you're wandering lost in that snowy forest, miserable, thinking that you've got no future, you're very inward turned, you're very self-obsessed. And so if you can just open to something that is bigger than you, bigger than your small mind, as they call it in Zen, then Shraddha has appeared. The beginnings of positive emotion are there. You're just opening to that. So far, it may not even be a loving response to other people. It's just a loving response to something. It's opening to something. Something within your life, within your experience, but something which is bigger than the small mind. So you're opening into big mind. Small mind is the tendency to want to protect the current limited version of yourself. The sense of, you know, this is me, anything else threatens that. I need to shore it up. I need to sort of bolster it. I need to put walls around it. It's as if the centre of your mandala is a castle. It's embattled. Now, Shraddha is when you leave, you go over those walls, you leave the castle behind, maybe you even start to dismantle it. You open to the landscape around you, the world, reality, in a bigger sense. So that's the beginning, this this ability to sense the possibilities of enlightenment itself, really. The ability to sense the value of Buddha, of path, and of community. That is what Shraddha is. Now, as that response, as that opening encounters other people, what it then turns into is metta, loving kindness. And I think for us, this is the working ground. Shraddha is difficult in itself to cultivate. Shraddha is something where you simply put yourself into conditions where you find yourself naturally opening. And you may find that the presence of art, whether it's Buddhist art or art in general, the presence of music and colour, the presence of devotional ritual, the chanting, beautiful architecture, all that kind of thing. If you put yourself in those conditions, you may naturally start to open and Shraddha arises. But as I say, it's difficult to sort of deliberately make it happen. If it doesn't happen, you say, oh well, maybe tomorrow, you know, maybe I'll try a different picture, see if that works better. But with metta, it's something you can cultivate. You start from the opening of awareness, but then you move to noticing the limitations of your awareness and working to melt those limitations. In a way, those are the two most important stages of the Buddhist path. You've got to be open, you've got to be grounded, you've got to be present, but then in that presence and that groundedness, you may well feel, well, you know, I'm open now to some extent, but there are some no-go areas. There are places where I feel scared. There are places where I've got very strong assumptions, preconceptions, expectations, self-view of what I should be, views of what other people should be for me. All these things are holding me in. They're holding me inside my castle. And so metta, the process of practicing metta, is to melt away, make porous some of those boundaries. It's a long process, it's a long practice. So Ratnasambhava represents the practice part of the path. You've opened from awareness, now you've actually got to start methodically working on yourself. And the working on yourself we call working with positive emotion. Primarily, that's what we're talking about. We'll see other kinds of insightful working on yourself tomorrow with Amitabha. But with Ratnasambhava, we're talking about that methodical improving your character, becoming a wider, more welcoming, warmer person, cultivating warmth, cultivating empathy, being able to put yourself into other people's shoes, that sort of thing. And out of that metta come all the other positive emotions, come compassion, for example, appreciation. Compassion is when it meets with suffering. Appreciation is when it meets with something positive that it really wants to rejoice in. Equanimity is the strength, the robustness of emotion. So you find that you can cope with the worldly winds. You can cope with all the vicissitudes of life as they get chucked at you because you've got that basic, in your belly, you've got something okay. You feel okay about yourself. That's equanimity. And that's very strongly associated with Ratnasambhava. That's where the abundance, the riches come from. Because you've got an inner resource, a positivity, you don't need other people to be a particular way for you. You don't need the world to treat you right. You're okay. You can be there. More than just being there, you can be abundant. Something can come out from you. And as well as the responses to other people of love, of compassion, of appreciation, we also have joy itself. Just joy in living. Joy in awareness. And this increases more and more if you can find you can get absorbed in meditation. So Ratnasambhava is associated with the positive experiences of meditation, of dhyana, that is absorption meditation. The intense satisfaction, the nourishment, the refreshment that can come from meditation, if that makes sense. So this richness of positive emotion, of positive qualities, leads to a sense of abundance. It leads to energy. It leads to engagement. And it's also associated, and this is, you know, one could just go on forever talking about these figures, but Ratnasambhava is associated with ethics. because Ratnasambhava is associated with living from skillful intentions, from those positive emotions, not just being good feelings, but from having an effect on the way you live your life, what you do with your life. That's what ethics is. Ethics is not following a system of rules. It's living from metta, living from shraddha, living from these positive emotions, and letting them have a bigger influence on your life than the usual small mind, the protective, castle-based behaviours and lifestyle. So one's not just being aware, but one's actively engaging with one's mental states, and one is living from skillful intentions. So, you might want to talk about that a bit more in your groups, about positive emotion. At the end of the talk, I'll give you a few suggested questions. But I want to come back to what comes out of that positive emotion. Do you remember I talked about the strength, emotional strength in the belly, the sense that you have got something robust and strong there that can cope with the vicissitudes of life, but more than that, which allows you to overflow. It allows you to be abundant. It allows you to be generous. And this is very, very much the feeling with Ratnasambhava. And for the ancient Indians, the greatest symbol of wealth and generosity was the gemstone, the jewel. So his name means the one who is born from jewels, or the one from whom jewels are born, Ratnasambhava. And I find this fascinating. In fact, that's the whole point of a gemstone, really, is the fascination. There is a little gemstone in the forehead of that Buddha in the window over there. And if you catch the light right, you'll see what they call, I think, fire. I think the word is fire, isn't it? The fire within a gemstone. The way it sparkles, the way it tells you that inside it there is some kind of a magical universe which little glints are coming out of. So when I was ordained, which is almost exactly 30 years ago, Vasantra was there, I was given the name Ratnaprabha. And Ratnaprabha means the radiance of the jewel. So you can imagine that I was already quite fascinated by jewels, but after being given the name, I thought, I must find out about jewels. And another guy on the retreat with us was a New Zealander called Ratnaketu. So Ratnaketu and I had a pact. We said, after this retreat, we're going to go to the Tower of London, and we're going to look at the crown jewels. So we did. After the retreat, we went down into the vault in the Tower of London, and we looked at the crown jewels. And of course, if you've just been on a 3-month retreat, you're very, very open to the experience of beauty. And so rather than sort of being annoyed about the wealth concentrated in the hands of these rather useless aristocrats or all that kind of thing, instead of that, we just enjoyed this display. The Queen Mother's crown is just like the Bodhi Mandala, because it's a ground made of diamonds. You're not looking at one diamond, you're looking at a whole array of them. The Black Prince's ruby in the end of the scepter, this thing that nobody quite knows the origin of, this huge red, enormous red stone. Lovely colour, the colour of Amitabha. So anyway, so that's what we did, trying to sort of have a sense of what jewels mean. Maybe you don't respond in that way, I don't know, but have a look at them sometimes. This is not jewels, this is amber, but there is that Ratnasambhava, the colour, the fascination, a warm stone instead of, well, you feel it and it feels warm. So in Buddhism, because the Indian mind loved jewels and regarded preciousness as being symbolised by jewels, the three central ideals of Buddhism were called the three jewels: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the most precious things in Buddhism. And there was another very important jewel, which is the Chintamani, the wishing jewel. This is the jewel that is said to bring you whatever you want. And the symbolism in Buddhism for the Chintamani, the wishing jewel, was bodhicitta, the mind set on enlightenment. If you've got enlightenment fully established at the centre of your mandala, enlightenment not just for you, but for the sake of all beings, then your world will turn out to give you everything you need. Ratnasambhava represents that sense of abundance. It's a difficult thing to... Of course, you might think, no, I need the castle. I need to protect myself. I need to worry about my pension. I need to make sure my job is secure, all that kind of stuff, which is fair enough. But what the image of the Chintamani seems to be saying is that once enlightenment, for the sake of everybody, is right at the centre, everything else will work out. It'll automatically arrange itself around it in the mandala. So this is why the wishing jewel is said to be the bodhicitta, the mind set on enlightenment. And remember the magical area around the Buddha at the time of his enlightenment. That diamond ground, the trees hung with jewels and flags and banners. And there's some lovely mythic descriptions of the enlightenment of the Buddha in this book, which is actually in three volumes. The Mahavastu is a beautiful old book, this. And it describes how, at the time of the enlightenment, all the trees around the Buddha swiveled to face the Buddha. It's as if there had been a strange noise and the deer all looked round and looked at the Buddha. But even babies in the surrounding villages in their cots peered over the sides of their cots to see what on earth was going on and looked in the direction of the enlightenment, because it's as if there had been some sort of an echo. Something had gone out. And this obviously symbolizes the fact that enlightenment isn't just a contained experience for one person, but it has repercussions. It spreads outwards. And so the devas gathered. Now the devas are the angelic dwellers, the heaven dwellers, who are always incredibly positive. They inhabit trees, but they also inhabit the realms, the deep realms of meditation. And the enlightenment attracted all the devas. They arrived in flocks. You could hear their wings rustling as they flew through the air. And it's said that the different devas, they gazed at the Buddha and they gazed at the Bodhi tree. They were particularly fascinated by the tree. They were gazing at the Bodhi tree. And it's said that those devas who were immersed in sense experience and sense gratification saw a tree with a wooden trunk and green leaves. But those devas who were immersed in the realms of the imagination didn't see a tree. They saw a jewel tree where the trunk was made of gold, where it was hung with rubies and amethysts and emeralds and sapphires. And those devas who were in the highest spheres of meditation saw a tree that was made only of light. So this is the description of the time of the enlightenment in the Mahavastu. I looked into this a little bit because I was interested in the connection between the events around the enlightenment and the different Buddhas. Akshobhya is associated with the defeat of Mara and the touching of the earth. That's quite clear. Amitabha is also in deep in meditation, is associated with the enlightenment. Virochana, the teaching mudra, the central Buddha, is associated with the Buddha's first teaching. But with Ratnasambhava, it's not quite so clear. But it seems that what the association is with this sense of enormous richness, colour, vibrancy and imagination that was there at the time of the enlightenment. So Ratnasambhava is the Buddha that introduces you to the whole area of myth, imagination, storytelling, wonders. And maybe you respond to that, maybe you like things to be very, very down to earth and step by step. But I like the Ratnasambhava realm myself. Okay, so what I've been talking about here is the possibility, first of all, of combining the two central ways of looking at Buddhist life, the path and the mandala. By seeing one's progress through the eastern gate round to the southern realm of Ratnasambhava, and then as we'll see, we go further round to the other realms as well. We're using a path and a mandala at the same time. And then I talked about Ratnasambhava's realm, the sense of warmth, welcoming and abundance and richness of Ratnasambhava's realm of positive emotion. The significance of his hand turning outwards in generosity. The importance of opening from small mind into big mind. The development of empathy with other people, awareness of others. And then Ratnasambhava's imaginative jewel realm. And the significance of jewels. So what Ratnasambhava is talking about is a change of mode, a change from the small mind to the big mind, an opening, a turning outwards of the hand. And in words that I remember Chakupala using in a talk, he talked about the change of mode from the acquisitive mode to the appreciative mode. I think that was right. I think that's what you talked about.
Appropriative.
That's right. From the appropriative mode to the appreciative mode. So from the mode where you're trying to get things all the time to the mode where you just let things be as they are and enjoy them the way they are without needing them to be special for you. And next week, if you're here for next week, I'm going to talk a bit more about that transition. But just have a little think about that, that sort of sense. Could you do that? Could you start to make that transition where you can simply enjoy the way things are, just open up to them by turning the hand outwards? A new way of being without self-clinging. This is where the small mind is relinquishing its tight control and we're ready to open. And what we're ready to open to is the deep insights that come with Amitabha, and we'll hear about that tomorrow. So I'll finish there, but I will suggest some questions. Do you see your life more as a journey or more as sort of making sense of a pattern, path or mandala? So you might want to talk a bit about that in the groups. Also, how do you relate to this whole language of myth and imagination and to the dual realm of Ratnasambhava? And in the case of Ratnasambhava in particular, how do you respond to his qualities and his associations, the earth, the horse, the jewel, the generosity and so on? Can you find a sense of Shraddha, of confidence in your life? Can you move into that realm of positive emotion? Where is it? What kind of thing is it that opens that up for you? I mentioned that you need to put yourself into conditions for Shraddha. You can't make it happen. So what are the conditions where you feel Shraddha, the opening quality, the confidence, is most likely to arise? Opening away from small mind into big mind. And how can you make the move in the path from that embodied mirror-like awareness of akshobhya to add to that the empathetic and the warm awareness that includes other people? And finally, how can you bring a sense of abundance into your life? How can you move from the appropriative mode to the appreciative mode?